hockey player. And man, that was fast. Well, I got off two courses without getting too bruised. And after the set was over, James Moody came over and gave me a big hug and said, man, you made it. Made me feel real warm. Gave me the courage.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at WSLR.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barasonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. On July 1st, 2024, the Supreme Court gave former presidents almost complete immunity from criminal prosecution. After taking office for a second term in 2025, Donald Trump has been using this power like a mob boss, shaking down tech companies, law firms, universities, and the media. His regime has ignored court orders. He's appointed loyalists to key positions, using the levers of power for his own agenda and vendettas. My guest is Barbara McQuaid. She served as a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. In her book, The Fix, she takes on Trump and his cronies. Barbara, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thanks, Marianne. I'm very happy to be with you.
The Department of Justice is under the executive branch, and this is one of the ways Trump is pushing through an authoritarian agenda. He signed an executive order designating Antifa, or anti-fascists, as a domestic terrorist organization, and he also put out a memo known as NSPM-7, which assigns federal agencies to, quote, investigate, prosecute, and disrupt protesters engaging in anti-capitalism, anti-fascism, and anti-Americanism. Now, the Prairie Land trial was the first of one of these tests of this policy. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, I am. It's an interesting case because certainly crimes were committed in that case. They vandalized an ICE detention center. They, one, even fired an AK-47 at a federal officer. So I don't want to minimize the seriousness of that case. But I think one of the things that the Justice Department did in that case was to advance this false narrative that the danger of domestic terrorism comes only from the left and that it comes from an organized group called Antifa. As Christopher Wray, the former FBI director, once testified, Antifa is a movement. It's not an organization. To think of Antifa is to think of feminism or the patriarchy. It's an idea. It is not a group. Now, this group was charged as a conspiracy. They do appear to have made plans to show up there to protest and to do things like slash tires and do other things that do amount to vandalism. The bait and switch here is by suggesting that this was all about providing material support to Antifa. It's mentioned in the indictment. It has no legal consequence whatsoever. What has legal consequence is a conspiracy to attack a federal government facility, including this shot with an automatic weapon. And so by using a different statute, that is providing material support of a crime of terrorism, and the underlying crime of terrorism was assault of a federal officer, they were able to obtain convictions here. But I think there's a little bit of a spin on this that is manipulative, that is furthering this narrative that this is all some left-wing organized conspiracy against America, when I just don't think there's any evidence of that.
One of the people who was sentenced wasn't even at the protest. He was sentenced for 30 years in prison for moving a box of pamphlets.
Yeah, these sentences seem to me quite excessive. Conspiracy law can be very far-reaching. As long as you agree that some member of the group will commit the crime, even if the crime isn't committed, as long as there is some overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy, that can be enough. But these sentences strike me as really out of whack. The man who pulled the trigger and hit a federal officer didn't kill him.
By the way, the federal officer is fine.
Well, yes, but attempting to kill a federal officer is a serious offense, and I think that person deserves serious punishment. But it appears that the others did not intend for that to happen, were not aware that that was going to happen. There was no death that occurred. It strikes me that those sentences are excessive. I'm sure they will appeal both for procedural issues of whether the terrorism enhancement was appropriate in this case and for substantive reasonableness. The attackers on January 6th who engaged in seditious conspiracy like Stuart Rhodes and some others were getting sentences in the high teens and low 20s of years, not 30 or 50 or 100 years. It just strikes me as a little bit out of whack.
I think it's pretty obvious that what they're trying to do here is they're trying to intimidate protesters.
Yeah.
And that's really worrying because the judicial system is going along with it. And to say that people are terrorists if they are anti-capitalist, anti-fascist, or anti-American, how does that even work? You can't speak out against capitalism?
So you can't speak out. The issue is about conduct. But I think you raise a very good point, which is that executive order, I agree, is designed, I think, to intimidate people who have progressive views from speaking out because they're afraid they will end up just like these people. Now, these people did not simply speak out or have certain views. They worked together to plan an attack on a federal facility, and that's the difference. We've also seen other instances of these cases fall apart in Chicago, the Broadview 6 case, which was a group of people who were, I think by some accounts, interfering with the movement of a federal agent, but a case that was also overcharged and where there was grand jury abuse, again, in what appears to be an effort to deter people from engaging in protest. But I think people need to understand the difference between peaceful protest and committing crimes. Just as the people who attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and some have portrayed as simply exercising their First Amendment rights. They weren't charged because they were exercising their First Amendment rights. They were charged because they assaulted police officers or they trespassed or they damaged property. You have to really separate the conduct from the viewpoint and the statements. And I think that's an important lesson when anybody goes out to peacefully protest, that it must be peaceful. You know, civil disobedience can be persuasive, but it has consequences. Rosa Parks went to jail for refusing to go to the back of the bus, and her statement got a lot of attention because she did go to jail, but she did go to jail as a result of that. So we don't have the ability to violate laws with impunity if we are going to break laws or, you know, damage property or harm other people. There will be legal consequences for that.
Unless you are actually part of the government, in which case, if you're an ICE agent, you can shoot somebody in cold blood and there's no consequences at all.
Yeah, I think that is deeply disturbing. The two incidents that we saw in Minnesota with Alex Pretty and Renee Good, the fact that there was no federal investigation for those shootings is really appalling to me. The standard to prove those kinds of cases criminally is very, very high. You have to show that a person deliberately deprived someone of their civil rights. Not that they panicked, not that they made a bad decision, not that they just made human error, but they deliberately tried to kill this person. I think there's a case to be made that that happened in both of those cases. It would be important to investigate. It would be important to know everything that was said and done, but they did no investigation whatsoever. And again, I think, as you have said, part of that is this effort to intimidate people. If somebody gets shot once in a while, maybe that is a deterrent for people to prevent them from engaging in political protest. But I think in Minneapolis, it really had the opposite effect. I think it had a galvanizing effect on the community, who suddenly had very good moral clarity about what was happening. And their continued protest is what drove out Greg Bovino, who was the head of Customs and Border Protection there, who was engaging in some very aggressive tactics. So I think that one takeaway is that peaceful protest works. You just have to make sure that you're not committing crimes of violence or property damage along the way.
Our lovely Supreme Court has given us so many gifts. They recently ruled that border agents can treat returning green card holders as applicants for admission, allowing the detention of lawful permanent residents with unproven criminal allegations. How is this legal?
I don't know that this is going to stand, because one of the things that the Trump administration tried to do in the first administration, Trump's first term in office, was to deny admission to green card holders. These are permanent lawful residents of the United States. They are considered U.S. persons, and that means they get due process rights. And so before you can take away someone's life, liberty, or property, you have to give them a hearing, fair notice, and an impartial arbiter. And it doesn't sound like that is being done. And so I think that that is teed up for legal challenge. And I think there's a strong argument that those green card holders should prevail, that at the very least, they're entitled to a hearing in court before there can be adverse action taken against them.
One of the things I really like about your book is the way the first half you go through all of the outrageous behavior that the Trump administration has been indulging in. And in the second half, you go over some of the things that we can do once the circus leaves town. A big part of how Trump got elected was the Citizens United decision. Can you just give a brief overview of what that is and how that helped to elect Trump?
Yes. So the Supreme Court ruled about 15 years ago now that it is a violation of the First Amendment to prevent corporations or other organizations from making expenditures or to even limit the amount of those expenditures. And since that time, we have seen just an explosion of super PACs and dark money. And so, for example, it's what allows Elon Musk to spend $270 million on Trump's campaign in Pennsylvania. For individuals, there's a limit on how much any of us can contribute to a candidate. But it's a real bypass of that system to just say, well, I'm not contributing to Donald Trump. I'm just spending my own money because that is a way I get to communicate speech. And so we saw Elon Musk spend all this money. But when you are funding ads, it's essentially a pass-through. You are essentially putting money in his pocket to say, I'll pay for your ads for you. Imagine if somebody paid all your bills and they said, well, I'm not giving her, it's not a donation, it's just an expenditure. I'm just paying all her bills. That would free your money to use for other things. And so as a result, we have seen just this explosion of big money, dark money, PAC money that influences elections. It goes back to a case from the 1970s called Buckley versus Valeo that also talked about money as speech. And I think they really missed the boat there. Now that we have seen how this is shaken out and we have seen changes in circumstances, I think that is a valid reason to overturn Citizens United, to restore meaningful limits on campaign expenditures. I don't think people should be allowed to spend more than $20 on the candidate of their choice. If we had numbers like that, it would allow everybody to participate. Instead, if you're very wealthy in this country, you know, the crypto industry now has all kinds of PACs, PAC money, and they're very influential in congressional races, and they can destroy careers on the basis of political advertising. So it's a serious problem. I think, one, it can be overturned. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon with this Congress. We are starting to see some states come up with some creative solutions. I know in Montana and Hawaii, they have plans where they are changing the benefits of being a corporation and forbidding corporations from making political expenditures. If you're incorporated in those states, corporations are just a creation of state law. And so they have taken away that power, which I think is very creative. In my home state of Michigan, there's a ballot initiative to remove that power from utilities that have monopoly power in the state of Michigan because it's been conferred by the state. Our utility is able to fund candidates and causes and pay for political ads in a way that can be very deceptive and misleading. So those are some good starts. Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire has actually proposed a constitutional amendment to say that we should overturn the results of Citizens United and permit reasonable limits on campaign donations and expenditures. I think that would be a great thing. You know, one of the real flaws, I think, of the original case law was this idea that money is speech and therefore protected by the First Amendment, because it really misses the parallel idea that is also a constitutional right, and that is one person, one vote. And when billionaires or corporations are able to influence the outcome of elections in such a skewed way, I think they're really disempowering the rest of us to have the same rights to vote.
Sarasota County Government will host another edition of their Civics 101 course this fall. The program allows participants to learn more about how Sarasota County government works behind the scenes. It includes interactive experiences, facility tours, and presentations. Sessions will be every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m., beginning September 3rd, and run through November 19th. More information and registration is available at scgov.net or by calling 941-861-5000. You're listening to the Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Barbara McQuaid, and we're talking about her book, The Fix, Saving America from the Corruption of a Mob-Style Government. One of the other problems that's really astounding to me is the amount of gerrymandering that's been going on. And it's been openly discussed as we're doing this because we know we can't win the elections.
Yeah.
And the gerrymandering needs to be stopped. How does that happen?
Yeah. First, let me talk about the concept, big picture, and then I can talk specifically about gerrymandering. I think one of the things that we have seen in this era of Trump is that winning is all that matters. Respecting democratic norms, respecting the separation of powers, respecting the two-party system has gone by the wayside. It is all about a naked and raw assertion of power. And that would make the founding fathers roll in their graves. They were all about restraint. They were all about anti-monarchy. They were all about virtue, and they were about preventing corruption. And by corruption, they just meant the values of leading our country with integrity. And so gerrymandering is the antithesis of this. The Supreme Court ruled in a case called Rucho a few years ago that political gerrymandering is permissible, or at least that the courts are powerless to change it because that's a political decision. Justice Elena Kagan wrote that that's just crazy. It's antithetical to democracy. And of course, they should be able to strike it down as illegal. But nonetheless, she was in the minority. And so now we have this ability for states to gerrymander if they want to. And then most recently, the court ruled that even if it has a disparate effect on race, for example, once majority black districts get gerrymandering out of existence, as long as it was just an effect and not the intent to do that, that's okay too. So it's really changed the landscape of what's happening in terms of political gerrymandering. We saw Tennessee gerrymander in the Memphis area to break up Memphis as one voting block and bust it up into three groups that combines little pieces of Memphis with large pieces of suburbs such that black voters in Memphis no longer have one district that they can control. So this idea of, you know, slicing it up in various ways to empower one party or the other is now permissible and highly sought after. I think it's terrible, and I think we've entered a nuclear arms race for this. The other thing is we're supposed to only redistrict every 10 years after the census. And instead, at President Trump's demand, Texas decided to do it mid-decade, and some other states have now followed suit. California and Virginia, in an effort to counter what they're seeing of Republicans trying to pick up some seats in the House had elections that voted in favor of gerrymandering, to favor the Democratic Party. But I think it's anti-democratic no matter who does it, no matter which party does it. One solution to that is something we've done in my home state of Michigan. We've seen it in a few other states, and that is an independent citizens redistricting commission. This was created in Michigan about 8 years ago. And the idea is you recruit people who are just interested in serving their state. They are not affiliated with any political party. There are some seats that are held by Republicans, some seats that are held by Democrats, some seats that are held by independents. And they get to work on redistricting, and they look at maps, and they do it based on common sense things like respecting city and county boundaries and making them roughly the same size and making them contiguous and respecting communities of interest. And as a result of that, the first election after those districts were created, voters elected to the state house, the state senate, and the governor's office, all Democrats for the first time in 40 years, because it finally reflected the will of the people. And so I think that kind of redistricting is just good government and should be done throughout the country. I think that if ordinary people could be brought in to understand the impact of Citizens United and the impact of gerrymandering, I think most people would be on board with good government. I think it is politicians and people who want to control us and our money and our votes and our policy who are skewing the playing field to their advantage. And so I think that we could get popular support for these things if we could go out and really educate people about what's happening.
That's the tough part, because one of the things that Trump has done is go after the media. Yeah. And unless they go out and look for different voices, they're living in a world that's very different from what's really out there. I'm amazed at how much he's been able to use threats from the FCC against companies to get them to toe the line. Is there any way to rein that in?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It reminds me a lot of what we saw in Hungary with Viktor Orban, who was ultimately defeated at the ballot box, you know, slowly, one by one, damaging the free press by attacking members of the media. And we've seen this across the board, as you've said, with the FCC threatening licenses. We've seen a ban of the Associated Press from the White House press pool simply for refusing to go along with Donald Trump's demand to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. We've seen these frivolous lawsuits against media companies, and then media companies kind of caving in some instances. And I think perhaps they are making a business decision that it's worthwhile to pay $6 million to resolve a defamation suit, because what they really want is approval of the big merger they're doing with some other media giant that's worth $10 billion. And so it's the price you pay to do business. And I think that is really to the detriment of the American people, who need credible voices in the media. So there certainly still are some credible voices in the media. But we've got Fox News that, as we know, paid a $787 million settlement for false claims it made relating to a stolen election in 2020. And there's still plenty of false information or misleading information that's out there. Even media companies that kind of both sides some of these kinds of outrageous situations, there's just no evidence that the Biden administration, for example, did anything to weaponize the Justice Department. And yet, very often, when I do media interviews and I point out what I think is abuses at the Department of Justice, they even say, what about our listeners who might think that the Biden administration did the same thing? Like, why are you giving them that airtime? There's just no evidence of that. But I agree that, that's a problem. But ultimately, Viktor Orban lost his election in Hungary, I think in part because people had had enough. They saw through it. And Peter Magyar, who won there, campaigned on this idea that the president was corrupt and that he had governed through hate and fear, and it was time to move on and restore some national unity. Maybe we can find a candidate who can share that vision here.
Yeah, that would be great. But there has to be trust in the elections. And that's why a lot of
what's going on around claiming that there's been voter fraud, which is different from election fraud. I forget who bought Dominion Software, the company that runs a lot of the election machines in the United States, is a big Trump supporter. And all of that software is not visible. The idea that there's people coming in who aren't qualified to vote one by one seems to be capturing people's imagination. But the idea that these corporations are going in and committing massive amount of fraud by putting in tens of thousands of votes in an instant, no one seems to be talking about that.
Well, we certainly haven't seen any evidence that that's happened. The other thing that is available for people if they believe that there is election fraud occurring is audits, recounts, and lawsuits. You may recall that Donald Trump tried all those things in 2020 and failed across the board and nonetheless persisted in his claims that Dominion voting systems, there was some whole Hugo Chavez in Italy and all kinds of things were connected and trying to flip votes from Trump to Biden. There's just never any evidence of that. But if there is any claim that there is some kind of malicious counting of votes going on, candidates do have the ability to seek recounts. They know from their polling data pretty closely how an election should come out in most communities. And if there's something that is askew, they have the ability to seek a recount or file a lawsuit for voter fraud if those numbers don't add up. So I think there are avenues for us if there are concerns about election fraud. I think that just as the Justice Department once enjoyed a presumption of regularity, I think our elections should also enjoy a presumption of regularity unless and until we see evidence of fraud. And we've just never seen it. A handful of people who are not eligible to vote every year, not in any kind of number that changes the outcome of the election. And we know about them because we catch them and they get prosecuted. So I just don't think it's a problem. I think what Donald Trump is doing right now is trying to advance that false narrative that it is out there. Seizing ballots in Fulton County, Georgia. There was recently a search warrant executed at an Ohio voter registration group. They're seeking voting records in a number of swing states. I don't know what that's all about, but I think part of it is just making this concept front of mind so that if Trump or Republicans lose badly in the midterms, he can start claiming voter fraud, election fraud, and other kinds of things, because he can never admit he lost. So he has to have somebody to blame it on.
There's a number of things that you outline in the book we can do after the elections when we have a Congress that is actually willing to stand up and do things. One of them is proportional representation. What is that and how would that help us?
Yeah, so this is an idea. It's actually used in some states, so it's not completely foreign, but it's an idea advocated by some political scientists. And it is an effort to create more competition in seats for Congress. The idea would be instead of having just one member of Congress from our district, we might have, say, five. And so in my home state of Michigan, where I'm represented quite capably by Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, a Democrat, she's got a lock on that seat. She'll have that seat for as long as she wants it. And something like 85% of congressional seats around the country are entrenched like that. They're either solidly red or solidly blue. And there's a candidate who's got it, and they're going to be there until they decide to relinquish the seat. And so to put a little more competition and a little more battle of ideas at play, instead of just one a member of Congress representing me in Michigan in my district, maybe we would have five. And so if my district is, say, hypothetically 60% Democrat and 40% Republican, currently Debbie Dingell gets elected and she goes off to Congress and represents us. But there's 40% of her district who's not really having their values represented because they're Republicans and they've got this Democrat in the House. So with this 60-40 split, three Democrats would get elected, two Republicans would get elected, and they would go represent the people of my district in Washington. And so everybody would get their values represented and their ideas represented there. The other effect it might have is over time, it may be that we end up with a broader mix of ideas there and a broader mix of representation. Maybe it even leads to the creation of new parties, some on the far right, some on the far left, some more in the middle, whatever we want to call them. And that's good for democracy, too, because when you have more ideas at the table, you are going to have to engage in compromise. And it won't be this sort of either or us versus them gridlock, I think, that we see today.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Barbara McQuaid, and we've been talking about her book, The Fix. Barbara, thank you so much.
Thanks, Marianne. It's been my great pleasure to be with you.